I'm delighted to welcome to this Irish American life somebody who is no stranger to us here at Luxman Ireland House. I'm speaking to Gina Guadagnino. Gina actually studied as an undergrad here with us many moons ago, correct?
I did, yes.
Thankfully you're doing some graduate work with us here as well and you perform a very busy role here on campus at NYU, but we're speaking to you today about your new book, your first novel, I believe, The Parting Glass, a novel is the subtitle?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. First of all, congratulations, Gina. It must be like post-labour, the birth of a child, to see it out and to be at this point. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of The Parting Glass and whet our listeners' appetite in terms of what you develop in this wonderful historical fiction?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. And yes, this is my first novel. I had been thinking about sort of the characters and the idea that became The Parting Glass for a while. I'd been thinking about writing about characters in the Irish diaspora in New York for quite some time, and I couldn't quite figure out, was I writing a novel? Was I writing a short story? I've written plays before. I was really interested in the idea of a main character who could code switch, who could speak, you know, with her peers comfortably, but who was also able to hide her Irish identity at a time when there was so much bigotry and nativism in New York in order to get a better job than she would have been able to get when she was openly Irish. And it wasn't until I'd been living in New York for many years, and I moved out of New York briefly, and I was just so homesick for Washington Square. And I got the idea to sort of write about the original inhabitants of Washington Square. And I thought it'd be interesting to take a look at one particular house on the square and sort of do an upstairs-downstairs style comparison of the people who lived in the house, and then maybe make that character I described to you my main focus.
So were you someone, Gina, to go back, were you always a crazy reader of books when you were young? Was being a writer, and you did an MFA,
in
creative writing and things like this. It sounds like this has been something that's been on your radar for a while, at least.
It has, yes. I have been writing stories since I was old enough to pick up a pen, and I have always wanted to write novels. And so it had been percolating for really a very long time. And, you know, as you mentioned, I did my undergraduate work here at Glucksman Ireland House, and I've been writing about Irish women and Irish women in the Irish diaspora for a very long time. Lots of short stories, lots of little vignettes and things, and I knew eventually I wanted to bring it all together as a novel.
What do you think, and this might be a difficult question to ask on one level, Gina, what attracts you to the Irish part of that story? And, you know, you could have looked at other ethnic groups, presumably, and certainly in the diversity of New York, there's a lot to draw from.
Sure.
Is there something in particular that's brought you to the Irish example?
Yes, it's definitely been my studies have been largely what informs the topics that I write on. But I came to Irish studies because, actually, of my Italian great-grandmother. She was a huge influence on me growing up, and she was always telling us, remember your roots. And with a last name like Guadagnino, it's no surprise to anybody that I am part Italian, and I grew up very close to the Italian side of my family, but I didn't know the Irish side of my family very well. So I had to go looking for my Irish heritage and my Irish culture. And that's how I got into Irish studies in the first place. There was nobody around to hand me my Irish culture the way there were people around to hand me my Italian culture. And so the more research I did, the more I studied the history of Ireland and Irish folklore and the Irish diaspora, the more I wanted to write about it.
So the protagonist in The Parting Glass is it Moira, is how she'd pronounce her name, or Mari?
Mari, I think. Mari Amara.
Okay. Yeah. But she anglicizes her name to Mary.
To right? Mary, yeah.
So will you, not to give too much away, but will you tell us a little bit about this character and maybe just how you developed her in particular?
Sure. So she and her twin brother have come over from a big house estate in Ireland where they have been working as servants. I won't explain why they have come over. That would be giving too much away. But when they arrive in New York, they're told right away that they're not going to be able to get the level of work that they were expecting or that they were used to because of this anti-Irish bigotry.
And this is about 1837?
1837. I think when they actually come over, it's 1833. And Mara right away is able to change her accent and adopt a different voice in order to get better work, but her brother can't. And so they're able to get work in the same house, but they have to pretend that they're not siblings, that they don't know each other, so that she can become a lady's maid, which is a position that would not have been open generally to most Irish women at that time.
So I know you well enough to know, Gina, that you do your imagination in terms of this character is fairly well grounded, if not very well grounded, in historical research. Is
yes,
that correct?
Very
Tell
much
us
so.
A little bit about how, what, you know, the nuts and bolts of how you kind of do that research.
Sure. I love reading first-person accounts, and I definitely delved into a lot of letters that Irish women abroad wrote home during this period, as well as primary source material about various hiring practices that existed during the time. I don't want to give away some of my sources because they'll actually give away elements of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say one of the sources I cite throughout the book is a actual manual called Duties of a Lady's Maid, about teaching a maid to become a lady's maid. And it would have been widely available at the time that the book takes place. Mara definitely would have had access to it and would have read it. It was sort of standard reading for the time. And there are lots of these types of guides. There are also these types of guides for Irish immigrant women about maintaining their cultural integrity in the New World, and then other books similarly aimed at getting them to assimilate. Those were some of the sources I looked at as well.
So is there a particular reason, Gina, why you chose the 1830s? I'd want to think that there's probably more written in a way on maybe from the 1840s onwards and kind of profiling the quote-unquote famine immigrants, as we might call it.
Yes.
Is there a particular reason as to why you chose the 1830s?
There is. And I think it's one that will really resonate with somebody else at Glucksman Ireland House, Kevin Kenny,
mm-hmm.
Our director. The 1830s was a really interesting period in terms of the formation of Irish affinity groups, both here in New York as well as back in Ireland, and various agrarian secret societies were sort of at their peak at the time. And again, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but they do feature very heavily in the plot as well. And so I was definitely looking to set the story at the time that those groups were really forming, but before they were too fully established, as they would have been in the 1840s and beyond. That decade really makes a huge difference.
So The Parting Glass, it's published by Simon & Schuster. It's not an imprint, right? It's Simon.
Atria.
Atria is the imprint. Yeah, I was thinking in the back of my mind. So can you tell us a little bit about the process, Gina, of working on a manuscript like this and getting to the point where it's no mean feat, presumably, to get a contract and to see it in its final form now.
Mm-hmm.
For aspiring writers who are listening, what was that process like?
One requiring great patience. It took me about 5 years of working on the manuscript before I had a draft that I wanted to start sending to agents. And part of that, which you've alluded to, is that I kept stopping my writing so that I could do more research. It was very, very important to me that the world I was writing about was deeply grounded in thorough and complete research. So it took me, as I said, about 5 years, and I think it was maybe my fourth or fifth draft by the time I started sending it around to agents. And that was an exercise in patience and determination, because I sent it to 181 agents and only one of them offered me representation.
Wow.
They say it only takes one.
Yeah.
And my agent, Alexandra Machinist, is absolutely the best advocate I could have asked for this book. She definitely believed in it when a lot of people didn't, and I'm so grateful to her for her advocacy. And she was actually able to get it in front of sort of a selection of editors who she thought it would appeal to relatively quickly, and Trish Todd at Simon & Schuster was interested right away. And so once I got to that process, once I finally had an agent who was willing to fight for this book, the process to publication was relatively quick and smooth. It was about a year and a half between signing the contract with Simon & Schuster and my publication date, March 5th. But that's pretty compressed for the publishing world. Didn't require a huge, huge editorial lift. And it was just absolutely wonderful working with Trish and her team at Atria. They were really just absolutely lovely, and I learned so much about the publishing process. But I think my biggest takeaway for aspiring writers is just to be very patient and determined. And there is a right person for every book. It's just about the persistence of finding them.
So would you have done things, you know, like you would literally have gone through the entire manuscript and rewrote it a few times before you felt it was at a point where you were comfortable with it going out?
I wouldn't say I rewrote it entirely. It had the first draft was really skeletal, mm-hmm. and it needed a lot of fleshing out. And I was very fortunate to have a number of friends, both from my MFA program and friends from college, actually, who are really voracious readers and keen editors, who were happy to read draft after draft, mm-hmm. and, you know, tell me where things were still lacking, or maybe where something was in my head but hadn't quite made it to the page. And so it was a process of sort of fleshing things out and refining things.
So, am I correct in thinking that this is part of a trilogy, Gina, or is that letting the cat out of the bag a little bit?
A collection rather than a trilogy,
okay.
Since I don't think I'm going to be stopping at three books.
But are you going to carry? Are you carrying over these characters into the next book?
The main characters, no. There will be some minor characters who show up in the next book, and some other minor characters who show up in the book after that. I'm hoping to do sort of a collection of books, Miriam, that could be read individually, and the reader could enjoy each one individually, but if you read them all together, it would form a larger picture.
Can I ask you, from, you know, the lineup of American writers, Irish writers, international writers, who are the writers that inspire you, like specifically in terms of how you wrote this and the genre of historical fiction?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and there are so many, so I'm going to give you the very condensed mm-hmm. version. Mm-hmm. I have huge respect for Sarah Waters, who's Tipping the Velvet and whose Fingersmith were very influential. Lindsay Fay, whose Gods of Gotham series, which is also set in a similar period in New York, was also very influential, as was Joe Baker's Longbourn, which all of those were kind of books that gave me a sense that there is a market for this type of historical fiction that explores differences in race and class and sexuality in ways that haven't been traditionally looked at as well. Emma Donoghue, of course, is a huge influence. I mean, you got to love her prose, especially. And the way she looks at historical fiction from sort of a marginalized lens is very interesting.
She does. I've had the pleasure of interviewing Emma, and she does a lot of on-the-ground research like yourself.
She does. That's another huge way that she's been influential to me.
So a lot of female writers, Gina.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I always like to ask this of writers, especially of historical fiction. Were you ever drawn to sticking to history just as a history book, or what is it about the historical fiction element that draws you in?
I think that fiction is a great way to explore narratives that we haven't seen before and to give voice to those who have been historically voiceless. Unfortunately, a lot of the characters who I deal with and a lot of the people who've been left out of history are people who aren't necessarily literate, who haven't left us their voices. And so I like to use historical research as a way to bring those people and their stories to life.
Okay. Can I ask you, Jean, about the title? In these quarters, I guess we associate the Parting Glass so much with the well-known song and tune. What was the logic, did it have a title? Did you come up with the title yourself, or was that part of the publication process as well?
I did come up with the title. The Parting Glass is one of my favorite songs. There are actually snippets of a lot of my favorite Irish folk songs throughout the book, and I knew that I wanted one of them to give to share the title with the book. Mm-hmm. There's a few different directions I could have gone in. Again, I won't mention what the other ones are because I don't want to give too much away, but by the time I wrote the epilogue, The Parting Glass just seemed like the most appropriate option, and so that's what we went with.
It's a great title.
Thank you.
Gina, can I ask you to read from The Parting Glass? Have you picked out a section that you love yet or anything?
I can definitely give you a section of it. Sure, okay, absolutely. It was nearly pitch dark when Shawneen arrived, the street lamps having guttered low. I had dozed off with my head on the carriage seat, but woke at once when he touched my arm. In the wan light, he smiled, his eyes gleaming. I smiled back, took his glove, and let him hand me down from the coach like the lady I'd never be. Softly, so our boots wouldn't ring on the flagstones, we slipped out the carriage house's front door onto the street. A clock struck one over at St. Mark's as we made our way west out onto Broadway. A sudden gust as we rounded the corner threw me off balance. I moved into the proffered circle of his arm, huddling close against him. A light snow fell, swirling in eddies over the cobbles, and I gripped his arm to keep from slipping on the shell of ice formed over the street. The houses and shops that lined the way were dark, silent, and we had gone several blocks south before we saw lights dancing behind curtain windows, and either of us dared speak. "Have you eaten?" he asked me quietly in Irish. "I have," I whispered back. "Have you?" "I ate, but I'm not yet satisfied." He smiled wickedly, and I shoved him, grinning in spite of myself. We crossed over Houston and down to one of the narrow side streets, a swell of light and noise rising to meet us as we came to Lafayette. Warm light and capering shadows thrown from the windows of public houses and dance halls stained the snow, a mix of song and laughter escaping from behind the doors. The Hibernian stood on Mulberry Street, on a block crammed full of public houses and a handful of the more respectable sorts of brothels. Like its neighbors, it catered almost exclusively to Irish, though one might find the rare Italian or Prussian who'd wandered north out of the Sixth Ward, the borders of which were still confined to the south. It was already all Catholics then in Mulberry Street, but the Hibernian was full of lilting voices from every corner of the island. Here, broad Galway vowels rubbed up against rapid Belfast chatter and clipped Dublin drawl. And from behind the bar, his heavy brogue booming over the din, reigned Dermot John O'Brien, proprietor and publican, who nodded to us as we entered. We nodded back, weaving our way through the patrons packing the place. At a cramped bench in the back, I waited while Shawneen sidled up to the bar. When he returned, he held two mugs in each hand, foam streaming down the sides. I had slipped off my bonnet and mantle, my face flushed from the heat of the room, and reaching for one of the mugs, gulped down half its contents in one swig. "Easy now," he said, speaking English this time. "It'll go straight to your head." "F*** it, Johnny," I said, using his English name. I took another swallow, having by now dropped the posh accent I adopted in the Walden's home and slipping back into my native brogue. "Just because you're buying, there's no call to be an ass." He spread his hands in a defenseless sort of gesture that I had been growing lately to despise. I turned my eyes back to my ale, scowling. He was always a great one for ruining a moment.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much, Gina. And I should refer your full name for people interested in finding out more about The Parting Glass, a novel, Gina Marie Guadagnino. It's available now, and many congratulations. Such a wonderful achievement. I hope the next installment has an Irish element, and even if it doesn't, you're going to have to come back and tell us about that. And best of luck with everything with this book and seeing it come to fruition. Keep up the great work, Sheena.
Thank you so much, Miriam. It's such an honor to be here, and I promise the next book definitely has an Irish component.
Great. Thank you, Sheena, so much.
Thank you.